The Local Thread.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to La Prensa Habla. My name is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are here today with two really, really fun guests. We're going to have them introduce themselves with the topic of immigration. So, Baldemar, could you go first, introduce yourself?
Baldemar Velasquez. I've been with the Farm Labor Organizing Committee for 56 years.
Hi, I'm Brenda Aranda. Me and my family, we run a food truck on the east side of Toledo. It is called Taqueria Otates.
Thank you so much for introducing yourselves and for being here today. Like I said, the topic is immigration, and I think everyone sitting around this table has a story that's very, you know, personal to them, their background, their upbringing, that could speak to the topic. Baldemar, what was your, you know, what's your background? I know you grew up in Toledo, but help us get to know you.
Well, I was born in South Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. It was a little town called Farr, next to McAllen, Texas, about 12 miles from the bridge into Mexico at Reynosa. And we were migrant workers from the Rio Grande Valley up into the Midwest, in Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, following the crops. And we got stranded in Ohio because in the 50s, when we first started migrating to Ohio, we relied on what we call crew leaders at that time to transport us in their trucks, flatbed trucks with wooden sideboards with a canvas thrown over the top, maybe three, four, five families crammed into the back. And one summer, we didn't make enough money to pay the truck driver transportation home. So we got stranded in Ohio. Up there.
So they weren't going to take a back pay, you can say.
No.
we'll pay you when we get there.
No. We had to stay up in right on the lake, and we were picking peaches at that time. And getting stranded near the lake, we didn't realize how cold it got up here. In Texas, we didn't even have heaters in our homes. It just got cold, just threw another blanket on. But it was so cold, and that old dilapidated farmhouse that we lived in, the only heat source was the stove in the kitchen. So the whole family moved into the kitchen for the winter. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any English, but I started going to school because it was warm in the schoolhouse and cold at home. And so, and then we borrowed so much money from the farmers just to stay alive. And next spring, we started working off the debt. And we never did get out of debt for like 5 years, as myself, I was 5-6 years old, and my other siblings got old enough to be more productive, picking faster, making more hampers, lugs, crates, baskets, whatever we were picking. Everything was piece rate in those days. So if we didn't work, we didn't get paid. And it took us about 5 years to get out of debt. Then we moved down into Putnam County, where I grew up. And of course, the silver lining is that I stayed in school, learned English, and I was going to become an engineer because math was my best subject, only because from the time we were 6 years old, we were counting buckets and hampers and crates, and everything was piece rate. Everything was being paid, you know, like a 33-pound basket of tomatoes was 10 cents. And so we had to learn how to multiply, add. My mom would always say, when you fill that bucket, just put a little rock in your pocket and we'll count them at home. Mm. And at night we were always counting and multiplying. Every one of these pebbles was a dime or a nickel or something. And so math was my best subject. And that's why I learned English, because I didn't use numbers, but I didn't know the language. When the teachers were talking about numbers, I matched the numbers with the word. And first grade, second grade, probably was when I started learning somewhat what the teachers were talking about. I wasn't a good student. It was like a FD, C student. Mm-hmm. And until I got into seventh grade, where, you know, you start playing organized sports. And I was good in all the sports, not because I was so talented, because I had a from working in the fields, a work ethic that went beyond what the other kids would want to, you know, sacrifice. And so what's changed my life around was being criticized by one of my teammates to say, well, you're a good football player, you're a good baseball player. Look at your grades, you're still a dumb Mexican. So at that point, I said, I'll never have anybody call me a dumb Mexican again. So I went to school the next day, and I took a dictionary from the library, took it home, and read. I knew I had an Ohio history test coming up the following week. I went back and read all the chapters, staying up till 2 in the morning, reading and looking up words that I couldn't understand, rereading it to find out, you know, what was really being written. And I aced that test. And by the end of the school year, I was on the honor roll and stayed that way through high school. So that started my career in learning something about American history and learning about Mexican Americans, Mexican people. Going back, and I went to undergraduate school at Pan American in Edinburgh, Texas, the only school I could afford to go to. My senior year, I wasn't expecting to go to college. I was thinking of going to the Marines, and I was an angry young Mexican. I was tired of the wage theft and the way the mistreatment in the labor camps, migrating up to Michigan, picking cherries, strawberries, into Wisconsin, picking cucumbers, in Indiana, picking tomatoes, in Ohio, all the farmers down in Putnam County, we worked for a lot of them. And there was always stealing our wages. And I knew it because I knew math. And we were getting paid by the acre, by the bucket, by the crate, by whatever. And they were always siphoning off our money. And I would complain to my dad. And my dad would say, if you complain about that, no farmer's going to hire you anywhere. And how are we going to eat then? And so that, I was pretty angry. And going to South Texas, Pan American, my freshman year, that was the turning point in my life, because I was living with my grandparents and hitchhiking the 10 miles to Edinburgh every morning from far. But I hated the way they treated my grandparents. I hated the way they treated my mom and dad here in Ohio, but I hated more the way they treated my grandparents. I mean, these are old people, and the way they treated them, followed them around in stores and looked down, condescending them. It makes any young man angry once they hit somebody. And that's what started my career. 65, that's when I was a freshman down there. It's the height of the civil rights movement. It was in the news every day. You couldn't help but be impacted by that, and said, if black people can do this, why not us Mexican people?
Seems as if, like, in the very beginning, you were going in just to work, but as you learned English and learned more things, that you started to understand what was really going on out in the fields. Because a lot of the, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the farmers and, like, the migrant workers did not know how to read or write or anything like that, right?
Well, let me tell you that the way things were in those days, the people around us that we worked with, it was like that's the way life was. And it's you just tried to go from one day to the other. There was no long-term planning. You never had the money to plan long-term. You just had to figure out what you're going to do next to feed yourself and your family. And so you had to go work. You didn't have time to think about anything else. But going to school and, again, learning what you're a part of, something bigger, and seeing how other people lived. And I used to be out there working on the side of the farmers' houses, and you see their kids your own age out there in the backyard playing ball and playing things like that. And I would say to myself, well, there's something wrong with this picture. They're out there doing that, and I'm out here breaking my back just to eat, and there's something wrong with this picture. So why can't we, as hard workers as we are, why is our future only designated to, when I'm finished with this row, there's just another row just like it waiting for me, and you're surviving from on that? That's your future. And I said, that's no way to live. And now these kids got all of that. You know, why do they have all this? We got nothing. I'm working like a dog out there. They're out there playing, and they got this, and they got there's something wrong with this. So the math helped me understand the economics of the system and who, you know, where's the money coming from, and try to understand the economics of any piece rate thing that we did, tomatoes, cucumbers, strawberries, whether fresh market or processing and sold, who gets the money, where does the money come from, all that, it was all math, and it helped me analyze the inequity of the supply chain systems. So when I started organizing 67, that was always in the back of my mind. I said, well, where is the money coming from? Who gets what? And the economics played a big part in formulating the future strategies that we used with the Farm Labor Organizing Committee.
I think I hear threads of being a hardworking family, having a commitment to education, and honestly, that helps remind me of Brenda, the little bit that I know about Brenda. I know that that's true about your family as well. So can you share your story, your family's story?
Yeah. My parents, they came here when I was 5 months old. I was, you know, swaddled in a blanket when I came here. And they worked very, very hard to try to work for themselves, because it's very hard, you know, to work for somebody else. And it's, you know, sometimes you don't meet the ends, you know, when you're working for somebody else. So, but she did, like my mom, she worked in the fields. She used to pick cucumbers, and I remember I used to go and I used to take a little thing of salt because I would eat them. I don't even think we washed these cucumbers.
Nope. You just give it a good old wash
yes,
on your shirt.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would see my mom, you know, picking cucumbers, and I'm pretty sure my dad had a job somewhere else. I can't really recall, but yeah, they worked really hard, and she worked at a factory, and then within time, she seen her calling as in, you know, having a food truck, and she's, you know, so blessed to have it. Like, she takes it so seriously, and I feel like I'm here, you know, to help her, you know, do that, which is very hard.
And you have kids now too, right?
Yes.
I'm sure that, you know, tell us about your family and how you've passed that on to your kids as well.
Yeah, they see us working, and I love the fact that I'm able to work and be there for my kids as much as I can, because it's so hard, you know, working somewhere and then trying to, you know, be in, on their schedule. And they see us working, and they're like, dang, Mom, like, that's a lot of work. I'm like, I know. I need you to help me. This is a family thing. Like, I want you guys to, like, pick it up so that, you know, you guys learn that it's great to work for yourself sometimes. If not, it's okay. You know, some people like to find a career and doing something else, and that's fine. Like, whatever you love to do, it doesn't feel like work, you know.
Do you know what drove your parents to this area?
Well, we had family here.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Sometimes I'm like, why Toledo? I couldn't have been somewhere warm, you know? But yeah, we had family here. Like, my dad's family was here, and they took us in, you know, until my parents got on their feet and stuff. And so we're really grateful for the people that, you know, was in our journey that helped us out.
And Baldemar, did you have anybody in your journey who helped you out? I mean, through your story, I heard a lot of resilience and a lot of seeing things for yourself and figuring out how to maneuver. Did you have a mentor or anybody who helped you through that?
Actually, the best teacher I ever had in graduate school, seminary, was my high school math teacher. I had 4 years with her. I had everything with her. I had algebra, I had geometry, I had, you know, trigonometry. She was a little old lady with a bun on top of her head, real frail. You thought she had, she would have the most unorganized class in the school, but she had the most disciplined class in the entire school system. And she made us recite word problems, get up in front of everybody and go through them. And you had to recite once a week. You never knew when she was going to pick on you at any given problem. So you had to come prepared for everything, or else she'd make you get up anyway and go through the problem and embarrass yourself in front of the whole class. So you came prepared, and I didn't dare go to her class without staying up and figuring out all the word problems that we had to present the next day. But she taught us how to analyze the entire universe. And she, that's what I learned to do. When I started organizing, I said, tomatoes, cucumbers, strawberries, whatever. What is the supply chain? Where does this go? Who gets paid how much for what? Who gets what portion of that? What much does the farmer get? How much does the retailer, the manufacturer, what does he charge for these things? It's all math. That's why I say she was my best teacher, because it helped me analyze things as to where the money, follow the money. And unfortunately, in this day and age, you can see it right now with the political, economic environment we're living in. It's all math. And you figure it out. Who's getting what? Who's the greedy ones? And who are the ones that's life siphoning things off other poor people's backs? And, I mean, I'm getting angry just thinking about it right now. So, anyway, that's what it is.
We'll give you a break. We'll let you take a breather. Brenda, I'm thinking about how you said that your mom had a dream to create a food truck while she was staying with her parents, right? So how did your family go about chasing that dream?
Well, in Mexico, my grandma, my mom's mom, had a little un puesto, como una, I want to say a brick and mortar is what we call it here, right? And my mom, she had seven sisters. And they all just had this little business of selling the really good enchiladas in Mexico. They were known for that.
So she had experience.
Yeah, she had the experience. And so she was the only one that came here to the United States and still pursued it, but within time, you know, because she, you know, had to get on her feet. And then, you know, she started going to these soccer games, as I had mentioned before, on many other, you know, news, you know, reports and stuff. And she found it there. Like, this is what I know I'm called to do, because she loves to cook.
You guys have some very inspiring stories. And it seems like, you know, in a way, you guys were also forced into leadership. When we come back, I'd like to dive into that a little bit more and dive into Flock and dive into your story a little bit more as well. So we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are here with Valdemar and Brenda, who both have such different stories and experiences that we are relating back to their journeys to this country and immigration. So a question that I want to ask both of you is, you're both doing such significant work that varies so differently. What is it that made you realize this is the work that I need to do?
When people have asked me that question in the past, I've always said it's not a career I chose. It's the career that chose me. Because from the time I was like 11 or 12 years old, and I saw all the abuses and all the way they would steal our wages that we worked for, honestly, with hard sweat, that when I grew up, if I could do something about this, I could, I would. And you have to give up things to make that happen. But one thing just leads to another. You can't stop when you got something started. And because a lot of people are depending on it. Things will never change if people don't do something. And a lot of times there's not a prescribed roadmap for it. There's no precedent. There's no blueprint to do this thing, especially for agricultural workers, migrant workers. We're excluded from the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, so we couldn't form unions in a legal way. We had to find alternative ways to do it. So the discrimination continues to this day, and the reason they excluded agricultural workers from the National Labor Relations Act, because at the time, President Roosevelt needed the Southern Dixiecrats to vote for the law. And their condition was exclude agricultural workers and domestic workers. You know, the black women who had attended the rich white people's mansions down in the South. And most of the agricultural workers in those days were black. And they couldn't see that black people would have the same rights as white people. So they excluded them from the National Labor Relations Act. And now most of the agricultural workers are Mexican or Mexican-American. And so we inherited that racist legacy to this day. And It's just something that you just can't let by. You got to do something about it. And that's what carried me into this lifelong work.
And Brenda, your family is so talented. You're so good at what you do.
Thank you.
What like creates that spark in you or created that spark in your mom to start the business?
I think being in Mexico when they lived there, it was humbling. It's very humbling. And just knowing that there's better out there, it's like you need to pursue that because sometimes we need to break them, you know, them chains of like, you know, being stuck in the same traditional way that some people feel like they need to suffer because it's happened for so long. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to break free from that. And so I'm very grateful that they had came here. I never thought that we would still have the taco truck for so long. Like I'm 33, but
you say that like you're old.
I know. And I always thought, I wonder what I would be doing when I'm 33 years old. But I never thought that I would still be doing the taco truck. And, you know, it's something that people depend on us. Like, they're waiting for us to open. And we always thought about, you know, having, like, a brick and mortar. Maybe one day we will, but it's within time. I don't want to rush anything. I don't want to ruin anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like within time it's going to come. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had to help my parents in a way of knowing how to do everything. Because now that there's so many food trucks, now there's more rules and regulations and put in place and stuff like that. And my parents, they didn't really know English. So I'm the one that had to take the role of, you know, I'm going to take a business class. I'm going to learn how to do this and that, how to do all of the ins and outs of trying to run a business, because it's not just selling food. We need to learn all these different methods of, you know, we were taking like cards and stuff, but then people are so, you know, they would do what's it called when they go to the bank and they dispute
charges.
And it's like, man, we work so hard for somebody to try to take their money back after they just ate some great food.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, we learned our lesson with that. We did that for some years. And, you know, it's just better, whatever works for us. And some people, that if they really want it, they support it. And they do. Like, we have a very good, you know, clientele with that. And we're so appreciative of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems as Latinos in general, mm-hmm. Whatever industry we're in, mm-hmm. There's always some type of injustice.
Yeah.
What does justice look like for you guys, whether it's the farm industry, the restaurant industry, mm-hmm. the construction industry, kind of like you said earlier, you know, it's like we inherited that like racist legacy, and we're always the ones that are getting underserved, underpaid. You know, so what does that justice look like to you guys?
Well, I think that in a sense, we're all connected. Our stories are really integrated together in the way things have unfolded in this country, like our educational system, the opportunities that we've been able to get into to open the doors to get our kids into education. We fought for the war on poverty under Lyndon Johnson. I remember when that started here in Ohio, there was a lot of help that came out, a lot of good things and some bad things that came out of that whole history. The good things are like Head Start, the food stamp programs and things like that, the people that are living on the margins. Those are all good things that came out of that, but there are some bad things. Mm-hmm. For instance, you can't subsidize structural inequality, and that's what they did to the agricultural workers in this country. A lot of advocacy groups that get federal funds to help migrants, they used to invite me to speak at their conferences. They don't anymore because I tell them, look, if you don't do more than that, you're subsidizing inequality, because the problem in agriculture really historically is the financial inequality in the supply chain system. And if you don't change that, you're stuck in it. Every food stamp you give to a farm worker because he gets paid so low wages is a subsidy to the agricultural industry, not the person who's sweating doing that piecework. Mm-hmm. Because what you're doing is subsidizing poverty to keep that person in the subsistent level of living, yeah. And to mm-hmm. provide cheap labor to this very high-powered, very mm-hmm. high-rich industry. the Campbell Soups, the Vlasic Pickles, the Heinz USA, the tobacco companies, the Philip Morris's, all of those companies are the pinnacle, the top of the supply chain that work off the sweat of the farmers, that they are their suppliers, and the workers that work on those farms. You have to have equity, and you can't subsidize that with federal funds. So that was one bad thing that happened. So they really froze our farm workers into a life of poverty. And we have to get them to break out of that. That's why we encourage the kids to get in college, get something better, get into a private business, you know, be a teacher, be a scientist. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck with a system of keeping people impoverished. And this is what's going on today, right now. If you look at what the agricultural industry is doing right now and the policies coming out of Washington, it's precisely that.
You know, and you hear the same when it comes to the restaurant industry, and I'm in the construction industry, and you know, I started my own business with the same idea, to be able to pay our people well. Because you go through so many, you hear and know about so many stories where, you know, guys are working all day, whether it's roofing, siding, you know, work that isn't easy, and you know, they're getting paid $100 a day versus, you know, what the regular rates should be. And same thing even in the restaurant industry. Some of my cousins would work at different restaurants and would get paid every 2 weeks like $500. You know, they're working they're working 60 hours.
Yeah.
You know, so what do you think we need as far as a community in the restaurant industry to make sure that there is justice when it comes to pay and treatment?
Yeah. Well, first, we would love to work without having to look over our shoulder. Mm-hmm. Mm. You know, we are so sometimes scared of, you never know when we could, you know, be racial profiled or anything like that. Like, it's so scary now. Now we're a target. And so now go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel like that fear is alive and well, and it feels like purposeful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's hard not to think, you know, you're expected to feel that way.
Yes.
And
it's sad because, like, I feel like I'm targeted because I'm a taco truck right there. There's Mexicans in there working. Like, you just never know, you know, when somebody can pop up and ask us, you know, for our documentation or anything like that. Not that we don't have it. Thank God we do. But still, people have them, that have their information and still, you know, get locked up for whatever reason.
Exactly.
And have to be in detention centers for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And there's no justice with that. Like, we just want to work. We want to make sure our employees are paid well, you know. We don't try to hog everything for ourselves because it's so hard. We try to help out as much as we can because we know how hard it is to maintain our living costs and expenses and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we just try. We try our best to stay positive when we are scared.
Yeah.
You know, because now it's like before, oh, yay, we have a food truck. It's the greatest thing ever. But now it's like, oh, my gosh, we have a taco truck. Like, that's scary.
Like, it's a target
Target.
Almost.
Yeah.
Oh,
like, it just, like, flipped. The whole switch flipped.
Mm-hmm. And something that I know about us and our people, or, you know, I know at least it's true about myself and my family, is life is happening for us, right? Mm-hmm. Life is not happening to us, and we could talk about the injustices for days, but I think something that we do is make it work in our favor, right?
Mm-hmm.
What ways have you seen that concept in your life?
I just try to lean more on my faith. I try to lean more on my faith because I don't want to be living in fear either, because I feel like when you're living in fear, it, like, truly happens. Like, you're kind of, like, I don't want to say manifesting, but you have to try to stay positive and not think of the worst. I feel like we just have to keep going, because if we're living in fear and we stay in our houses, not saying that, hey, you know, get out there. Luckily, I don't see anything happening here in Ohio and Toledo. Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never heard of any stories of, like, you know, ICE coming here. And I'm hoping they don't, you know, because I'm like, dang, are we really going to be able to start up our business this, you know, this year, you know? So it's scary. We might have to look for another job if it gets worse, just so that we ain't targeted.
And like you said, you have your documentation, and the fear still exists amongst us because of the racial profiling.
Yeah.
Baldemar, how do you see that life is happening for us and not to us.
Well, I think that's been an issue in my whole life career in terms of reconciling where we are and what comes against us. This immigration issue is not new. Mm-hmm. We've been dealing with it for the whole history of Flock. 1970, there was a raid in the tomato field in Putnam County. They arrested 11 or 12 workers. Most of them were American citizens. They took them to the Putnam County Jail. There was a confrontation between the workers and the sheriffs who came to back up ICE at that time. And we had our first demonstration here in Toledo in 1970 when the old federal building was there at where Promenade Park is now. And we bussed those workers up here and demanded that they stop, you know, profiling us and stop mistreating us in that regard. So we've always had immigration issues in Northwest Ohio. We've had problems with ICE over the years, but now it's really intensified because of the political dynamics in this country today and the issue about the border, which is neither Democrats or Republicans have really addressed that issue correctly. Everything is, it's like attacking a symptom of a deeper problem mm-hmm. in this country. What happens at the borders, nobody's asking, why are people migrating in the first place? Mm-hmm. A lot of that can be traced back to our trade agreements and foreign policy. And I think that that's the thing that's not being addressed. And we're trying to create some education and voice about that in the country, to create a dialogue about that now, because it's not going to change. The problem that people looking over their shoulder right now, the fear that that pervades among our people, right now ICE is focusing on the major cities. In time, it'll come down with the funding that ICE is getting now. They're increasing the amount of ICE agents and immigration oversight and dismantling the court systems mm-hmm. where people should be being processed in a more efficient way. It's cockeyed backwards, and you're exacerbating the deeper problem we have. You might have stopped the pressure on the border for now. It's not going to last forever, because when you have policies that displace people in the countries that they're from because of our trade agreements and foreign policy, it's something's going to break somewhere. Mm-hmm. And if it's not our border, it's going to be somewhere else. And I think this is what we're dealing with. We're all connected. I don't care whether you're running a food truck or you work out of our office on Broadway. We're all connected to this issue. We have to do something, and we cannot do it unless we unite and respond together, as opposed to trying to survive out there on our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Brenda, you were around when the dreaming, you know, being a dreamer mm-hmm. was a thing that since, you know, no longer exists. But right. Talk to your experience about that.
Yeah, I got DACA when I was in my senior year. It was back in 2012, and I've had it since then. And, you know, I'll always renew it. I don't break the law. I try to do everything that I possibly can to not get in trouble. I mean, I'm not.
You're on church on Sundays. Yes. I know you.
Yes. Yeah. So, and it's just like, when are we going to get our peace of mind of knowing, like, hey, now we either have either a permanent residency or a citizenship. I feel like we worked up to it. Like mm-hmm. we've already, you know, put so many years in it. Why can't we have our proper documentation to not be afraid that, hey, we can still, you know, be deported some way, somehow, mm-hmm. you know?
How do we encourage our community to unite? You know, because we've talked about, you know, we all have very similar backgrounds, but it seems like as if we're always in fear. We always are looking over our shoulders. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you have someone speaking up, there's always some like a whether it's envy, fear, whatever it is, mm-hmm. it's always in the air. How do we encourage our community to support those leaders that are speaking up?
I think we all just need to come together one day and organize something. Like, you know how FLAC always has, like, if I remember there was, like, marches and stuff like that. We all have to stand up, because if we don't stand up, it's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. We have to know that we have a backbone here in Toledo. There's great people that work here, great businesses that are ran by, you know, the Hispanic community. And we try our best to really stay in tune with whatever we're supposed to be doing. And for us to just, you know, try to ruin that for the fun, we don't try to do that at all. Mm-hmm. We try to really stay on track and do what's best for the community and feeding them and taking care of them and, you know, being a voice for them and stuff like that. And we have to do that because not everybody can.
We have to propose a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I really appreciate all the defensive measures being made by organized labor, mm-hmm. by community groups, nonprofit groups, and trying to defend people, doing education among people what to do if in encounters with ICE at home and at the workplace, and you know, wherever there may be an encounter. But we have to do more than that. These are all defensive measures. What is our offense? Mm-hmm. We are trying to propose a solution to this. We are calling for a repeat of the Reagan Amnesty of 86, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. Modernize it. Bring it up to date. And because that would wipe the fear away from the people they're experiencing right now. We can't do that unless we do a couple things. One, step up and sign support for this resolution that we're circulating for immigration reform. That's got three parts to it. One is the immediate amnesty. Update the IRCA law of 86 and use President Reagan's language on it. He says, we need this workforce in this country. Our economy needs this workforce. Mm-hmm. We don't have the population growth in this country to fill the jobs that we're going to have in the next decade. And they're going to be filled by immigrants. What, legalize the people that are here have not committed any crimes? Mm-hmm. Because in the real criminals that they talk about, those people are not going to come out of the woodwork. They're not going to come out and get fingerprinted and run through the criminal databases. The people who have done nothing but be here without authorization, they're going to come out. They're the people that we need here. And so we need to call for that first. Tie it to our trade agreements. We need sustainable trade agreements and sustainable foreign policies. We can't support dictator governments that oppress local people trying to make their own life in their own country and oppress them. But when they start to organize, we can't be funding those kinds of governments. We need a better foreign policy and better trade policies that don't displace people and minimize those consequences.
You know, that is such a great message, but we do have to take a break. We'll be back with our word of the day, and also we're going to get some delicious Mexican food that Brenda brought in for us. So we'll be right back. All righty, welcome back to our third and my favorite segment, because we have some delicious looking ceviche here with us. My name is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina, and ceviche is the word of the day. So we've been so lucky to have Brenda bring us some ceviche. So Brenda, tell us where this is from and how did you make it?
Yeah, it is a very great recipe. It is so good. It's super simple. It's very simple.
Kevin's crunching in the mic.
It's really good. So it has crab meat, shrimp, lime, cilantro, onion, tomato, slices of avocado. Also, there's some ketchup in there. There's ketchup in there to keep everything together. I know
it's
a lot of people are like,
sauce.
Right, a lot of people are like, that you don't make ceviche with ketchup. I'm like, hey, it works for us, and it's great. It tastes really good. Yeah, we've been serving ceviche from the food truck for a very long time. We also sell, like, shrimp cocktails. So it's almost like in the same dynamic, but it's more of like a soup, cold soup that you eat, you know, with just shrimp and the same ingredients like cilantro, onion, tomato, and avocado. Mm-hmm. It's a great mix. And it's funny because I think about the Mexican flag, and the Mexican flag is, you know, green, white, mm-hmm. and red.
Yes.
So the cilantro, the onion, and the tomato.
Those colors are popping through. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah, everyone loves a ceviche. I like it with sour cream. There is this lady that went to the taco truck before, and she was like, hey, can you put sour cream on the shell first and then put the ceviche on top? And I'm like, yeah, we can. And I was like kind of iffy about it. Uh-huh. And I was curious. So I tried it and I'm like, oh my God, it is so good like that.
That's like the secret menu for the taco truck.
Even some green salsa on it would be really good. Mm. It's known to use, you know, Valentina salsa on it, like how Kevin just poured some on there. Is it good?
Oh yeah, it's so good. It's so good. I'm trying not to eat all in the mic while you're talking. It's delicious.
But he's also so happy that you're talking. So
yeah. Go ahead.
Valdemar, did you like it?
It's the best ceviche I've had since I had a dish in Veracruz, Mexico.
Oh.
And it was done with fresh seafood and marinated and a lot of lime. And mm-hmm. It was very, very good. I never had great ceviche until now.
Oh, thank you.
Is this the dish that you can like add like alcohol with it or whatever? Or
oh,
like?
I don't know.
No.
I don't know. Like, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean, but yeah. I don't know.
Is there like a lot of different ways of making ceviche, or is it just one?
There
one
is.
Way
I've heard there's many different ways, but this is like the only way I know how to do it.
It sounds like you've perfected it, though.
Yeah, it doesn't need too much. Sometimes when we put too many ingredients of you know, all these different kinds of things in one thing, I feel like it could throw it off. Mm-hmm. Too many flavors going off at one time, maybe. Mm-hmm. You just need that, like that, you know, like that. Oh, that's good, you know.
Yeah.
It could just be a hint of lime mm-hmm. sometimes. Or the salsa. The salsa has to be really good. It has to be, you know, not too liquidy. You don't want some watery salsa. It has to have this thickness to it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when we're having the food of the day, we always look up fun facts. Mm-hmm. And ceviche is very fitting to our topic because it's considered a migration dish.
Oh, really?
Yes, look because it started in the coastal regions mm-hmm. and then migrated throughout, you know, further away from the coastal regions.
Mm.
And as it migrated, it took on different forms, different ingredients, different flavors.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
Fun fact for the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like, you know, we've been selling it for you know what? Come to think about it, my brother corrected me. He's like, hey, when my mom first started selling food, you know, she first started selling ceviche and cocktails first before she started selling tacos. He's like, I remember. I don't remember because I was so little. Mm-hmm. I don't recall. But I remember there was this one day when we were at the soccer fields when my mom was selling food. And I remember I did have a plate of ceviche. I was sitting down and it was windy. And I sat down, and I was about to eat my ceviche, and the wind gust came, blew the ceviche on my face, the plate.
My gosh.
I was so upset because I was about to smash. But yeah, that's just a little memory that I recall. But yeah, like Taqueria Otates is known, you know, to serve great ceviche. A lot of people just go there for the ceviche. Mm-hmm. And Taqueria Otates, a lot of people wonder, you know, what is that name? Like, what does it mean? Where did it originate from? Well, mm-hmm. taqueria is known is the word for like a taco shop. And Otates is the little village where we're from in Mexico.
Oh.
We're from Guanajuato, Otates.
Mm-hmm.
Well, San Jose de Otates, Guanajuato. It's such a long name. You know how Mexicans have long names. But yeah, so that's where it originated from. And I think it's very... It's sentimental because we have a meaning towards this food truck. And it's painted all around it. It's like a little village with cactuses and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great.
Where is it? I know you said the east side, but where is it located?
So it's like right in between Nevada and Navarre. The address is 708 East Broadway, and we're, like, in this big open lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, like, kind of hard to miss us, but we are, like, kind of, like, in there inside of the lot, not too out in the street where you could see us.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, a lot of people know where we're located, and it's always been our spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we moved to, like, in that same spot, we probably moved, like, on the side of the other house. Like, we were just always – that was always our address. But before, for, like, 10 years straight – we did sell at the soccer fields just only on Sundays. And then we gradually came to the east side, which was closer to our home. And It was better that way because we used to drive over here on Glendale at the Snyder Soccer Field. That's where we started. So, oh, no, no, that's not where we started. I've been getting corrected by my brother. He's like, hey, you know, it was over here. It was on Console. Then it was at Snyder. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I was little. I just remember being so tired and my mom's, you know, forcing us to get up. Like, come on, we got to go work. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. But, yeah.
Looking at the ceviche, I can't help but think about, well, I see tomatoes, right?
Yeah,
I can't help but think about, you know, Baldemar being, growing up as a migrant farm worker. I did too, you know, my family, and I'm sure yours, we picked tomatoes. Baldemar, do you have any stories boycott related to tomatoes? For, I know there's the notorious Mount Olive pickle boycott. I think about that sometimes when I have Mount Olives in my in my fridge.
Yeah.
But tell us, was there a tomato boycott or a tomato?
Oh, yeah. That was what put Flock on the map, the Campbell Soup Strike of 1978. 2,000 of us walked out of the tomato fields all over northwest Ohio. I mean, you could drive from Perrysburg down to Findlay, Ohio. You couldn't help but smell rotten tomatoes. In that strike, when 2,000 people walk out and let the tomatoes rot at the peak of the season, that strike lasted for 8 years. So we did a boycott of Campbell's Soup for 7 years. And finally, in 86, they did what everybody said they'd never do. They sat down with Flock and negotiated a supply chain labor agreement, the first in its in history, because we negotiated not only with our employers, the farmers, but the company that bought the tomatoes, because we had to increase the price of the price per ton of the tomatoes so that it can increase our wages. And we did not close that boycott of tomato products. And Campbell's subsidiaries, one of which was Vlasic Pickle, we did not close the boycott until we got a procedure to unionize the cucumber workers in northwest Ohio. Because a lot of the workers that were picking tomatoes, they stay the same crews and harvest the cucumbers after the tomatoes were done. And so we understood that. That was the system. I said, they're already in the union in the tomato part. They should be in the union on the cucumber side. Since Vlasic was a subsidiary of Campbell's, it's the largest pickle company in America, we decided that would be the proper strategy to do. So they gave us a system, and we created a National Labor Relations Board by private agreement with the help of John Dunlop, former Secretary of Labor. And we created a mechanism to unionize the unorganized workers without a legal framework. It was by private agreement. So we have a National Labor Relations Board by private agreement that still exists to this day. And every company we go after, like the Mount Olive Pickle Company, we have to recognize that commission first in order to have the framework to unionize the workers, which has gotten a lot of workers out of poverty. My biggest reward right now is that the kids that were children during that Campbell Soup Strike, they were like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Sometimes I get calls from them from South Texas. Hugo Salinas, for instance, called me last year. He's now the athletic trainer for the entire Brownsville High School athletic department. And he calls me and says, Señor Velasquez, thank you so much for teaching us how to fight for ourselves and that we're not dumb and stupid Mexicans, that we were smart. And I went, gave me encouragement to finish school and go to college, and this is what I'm doing now. And I've had calls like that from women who are now teachers in Westlaco High School, middle school teachers. To me, that's what this is all about. It's not about, you know, building some kind of monolithic union movement. It's about changing people's lives, giving them opportunities that would otherwise have been left to live a life of peonage in agriculture. So same thing right now with the immigrants, the migrant workers, whether they're agriculture or not. We have to give them hope. We have to give them something to live by. But let's take the fear away from them create a national discussion. This resolution we're circulating, we want to make it a national discussion. This is not just a flock thing. This is an everybody thing. We encourage people to sign on and support that resolution. And go to flock, info at flock.com, info at floc.com. And to support this resolution and get a copy of it, we'll make sure that it's posted online on our website, floc.com. And we ask people to encourage it. And the local immigrant population, who has joined Flock. You're an immigrant. You should be part of something bigger than yourselves. You should sign up and come to the meetings, come to the marches, so we can fight back and create a maybe the next midterm elections, flip one of the houses, so we advance some proper legislation by elected officials that we choose. And we write the law, and not some of this low-hanging fruit is going to take 50 years to become a citizen, mm-hmm. and work it through all kinds of loopholes. I mean, up to 1959, I think you could enter from Canada and be in standing on your way to citizenship. But they've changed the laws. They've restricted the laws. They invaded our country. They took a land that wasn't theirs and redrew the boundaries, and they closed the door behind them. And this is wrong. We're not calling for open borders. We're talking about a regulated way in which people can come into this country, who are contributing to the economy, who are already here, and create a system to have real serious controls. But we have to stop dismantling the adjudication systems, canceling the asylum visas, canceling the protective status. Right now they're canceling all of those. They're going the opposite way, mm-hmm. and it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's going to make America the pariah of the world, and we have to make this country what we decided it was in the first place.
So every episode we try to have a detail, and this episode we are wanting to know, what is a detail or a saying or a mantra, however you want to think of it, that leads your work or inspires you, you know, on any given day?
Si se puede.
Hasta la victoria.
Mm-hmm.
You got to struggle until you win, and there's no giving up. Mm-hmm. And it's grounded by what us people who call ourselves Christians, you know, what faith is. Faith in the change, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
Mm. When you say, si se puede and hasta la victoria, it reminds me of the picture of you with Cesar Chavez, you two marching together, that we had blown up and framed and put in Escuela Smart. Tell us a little bit about that.
We had my first encounter with Caesar was in 1968. We had just started organizing, and as part of the midterm study that I did, I did a paper on farm workers, and I went out to interview Caesar. I told him that we were organizing farm workers in Ohio. I met with him at that, you know, in the 40 acres there in Delano. And we kept in touch from that point on. I got a stack full of letters in a file in my office, back and forth with him. When we did the Campbell Soup boycott, he invited me to come to one of his conventions in Fresno and got the endorsement of the United Farm Workers, when the rest of organized labor was against us. Because we were boycotting a, quote, union product, because the cannery workers were organized at that time. And I said, well, they're not entirely a union, because somebody's got to pick tomatoes to go in the cans that your members are processing. So we won that fight without it, but Caesar came to our support and turned the National Farm Worker Ministry to be the advocate and lead in the churches, which is what helped us win the boycott. It was support of the National Council of Churches, support of the National Council of Catholic Bishops, and all of the people that came to our aid. Bishop Hoffman was the Bishop of Toledo at that time. He was a phenomenal supporter. He took it over the head by these Catholic farmers in Putnam County. But he said, that's what Catholic teaching requires us to do. And we have to live by what we say we believe in. And Bishop Hoffman was a good friend of my mom's. My mom did the catechisms for the migrant kids in Putnam and Henry counties. And so there was a lot of interaction with people in the community, with the churches. And Caesar was one of the ones that helped us make those connections. Spent a lot of time with Caesar in California and Texas, in Ohio and Michigan. The last time, before he passed away, it was like 8 months. It was there was a march in Lansing. It was Farm Worker Day or something, and we marched together there. We have pictures of that last time we were together, and it was very sad when he passed away for many of us because of the standard that he set, you know, to sacrifice everything to do this work. It's not for everybody. Not everybody can do what he did. To make the sacrifices that he did, sacrifices that a lot of us made in order to make all this happen.
Yeah, you've got some really incredible stories. I wish we had a lot more time to really dissect those stories. But I want to thank you for your time. Brenda, thank you for
thank
your
you
time.
Kevin.
So thank you to Jessica as well and all of our listeners on La Prensa Habla. This is Kevin.
And I'm Jessica. Thank you so much.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.